From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 474, SQL Q&A at SQL Intersection Spring 2016 with guests Brent Ozar, Paul Randall, and Kim Tripp, recorded Thursday, April 21st, 2016. Run As Radio is produced each week by Puop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. I'm here in Orlando at SQL Intersection with a throng of enthusiastic SQL people. And the Three Stooges.
Oh.
Well, you put it on the slide this time, so it's...
That's true.
Kim Tripp and Paul Randall and Brent Ozar. We have a cast of additional experts in the front row. We'll also have a microphone. We're going to be doing Q&A. Folks, I've been running around like mad at the show as usual. Tell me how the SQL show went.
Good.
Fantastically well.
Did you guys have a good time too?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Love it. Yeah.
Especially SQL After Dark.
Oh, yeah. I heard standing room only for your evening session.
Yeah, that was great fun.
You guys always do the trivia and Brent always loses?
Yes, always. Not
trivia.
Even close.
Nice. We have a huge screen load of potential question topic areas here. So if anyone is fast with a question right off the bat, by all means, get your hand up and I will.
Time for Richard to get his cardio.
Yes.
Just one
this is my
workout.
I wear the light polo shirt for a day like today because I'm going to be doing some running here and we've got a pretty big room.
The questions don't have to be limited to the topics up there, but that's where we probably have the most expertise in the room is these topics. But if there's something else that's SQL related or scuba diving, that's fine too.
And if you don't have questions, we will talk about something we want to talk about.
Yeah, we can just start talking about other stuff too.
Wouldn't be the first time.
There you go.
The first question.
Fantastic. Hi there. What's your name? Where are you from?
Peter Tran from Houston, Texas.
Whoa! He has his own fan club. Wow.
So, we're an ISV. I love you too.
The fans,
were they the ones?
Let's meet later tonight. So I'm at ISV going out to visit a lot of customers, and the struggle I have with them is trying to convince them to upgrade to SQL Server. You know, some of them are still on 2008 R2. So when I go talk to them, I mean, of all these stuff and things that are coming down in 2016, what would you guys, like, if I had to pick, like, just a handful of stuff and try to convince them to upgrade 2016, what are you guys excited about?
Query store. For me, query store is so huge, especially for ISVs, because you constantly have to parachute in and go, why does this query suck today where it was awesome yesterday? Query store gives you that monitoring tool that we didn't get unless we got the customers to buy a monitoring tool. ISV customers never want to spend that $1,000, $2,000 to monitor your SQL server. They're like, you should know what sucks about your application. You should know which queries are slow. So having query store built in gives you that capability. That, I think, is...
I would actually agree. That's my favorite thing, too.
That's just hurting my billing rate, guys. If I could solve problems that fast.
They don't know how fast you can solve them, though.
No, oh, I see. Right. So figure it out right away, but take a few hours.
You should make sure. Yes.
Run it again and again.
The only thing I'd say is ISVs, it's tough because they have to do extensive testing. And they also then have to, if they take on some of those new features and they take a dependency on, let's say, 2016, they then have to require every one of their other customers to upgrade to 2016 as well. So it is a little bit of a double-edged sword. I feel
unless
a little
you
bit...
support multiple versions.
Yeah, but they also try to sometimes run on multiple platforms, so they end up being kind of jack-of-all-trades, master of none, so they're not actually leveraging a lot of brand-new features. They leverage ANSI, SQL, and they... So it depends on the vendor. It depends on how big or small. It depends on even sometimes the relationship that you create with the vendor, because I've seen numerous cases where people have problems with an ISV, and they actually start getting to know the support, and then the support even actually allows them to add indexes and then supports them for those indexes. So there's different ISVs deal with things differently, I guess is my point. So I think it's going to be different in almost all cases. Stop it.
your microphone is rubbing on your clothes.
There's clothing changes happening right now.
That don't know what's going on. My husband is pulling at my clothes. That doesn't really sound right now, does it?
I was thinking more like, wasn't the first time.
Yeah. So I guess the whole, it's a really tough discussion. If I'm just trying to convince someone to upgrade to 2016, I think that's a different argument. I just think ISVs, since they are not the someone themselves, they're selling a product to many someones, and they're going to have to convince all those someones for the licensing changes. I mean, this is something that a lot of ISVs are slow to move to because there were so many changes in 2012 and higher. So that's why some of you guys are still stuck on 2008 and 2008 R2.
Well, isn't that just the big socket versus core debate for licensing?
Yeah, but that turns into
lots of
dollars.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of compelling things. The feature that I like that would not apply to most ISVs, that's my favorite, is column store. Mm-hmm. There's very specific environments where that would be unbelievable in terms of the gains. So if the right ISV application existed that needed that, then yeah, I would say, I can't believe you haven't considered this.
So one thing I would say back to you, Peter, is what are you going to use in 2016 that's going to be compelling your clients to move?
Well, or what does he need that he wants?
Are you wanting to move just to get people to 2016, or is this something you really want to use in your product?
Well, he wants to convince the ISV to move. So what is it that you need in 2016 that you're trying to convince the ISV to use so that you can leverage it?
Yeah, I agree. And the query store was probably my favorite too.
Okay.
So
cardinality estimator would be the other thing I'd throw out there. You got not your code, but some ISVs have bundles of crappy code that suddenly becomes magically fast with the new cardinality estimator. You just want to test that first to know that you're on one of those paths that'll get better instead of worse.
Okay. To tag on to that, I would also argue sometimes environments are so well tuned kind of with the old CE. Well, not necessarily really well-tuned, but...
You know, we're talking about Peter here. Of course it's well-tuned.
Yes. But they're so focused on the old CE that moving to the new CE, they actually get a lot of...
Regressions
that cause problems. So testing, which you already said, I just want to dovetail on that. You absolutely do want to do testing. And some people will see some queries get faster, some queries get slower. But it's not a panacea for, you know, everything is going to be 10 times faster. And so you've got to be really careful for what you wish for.
And from Microsoft, we have...
Yeah, David.
You chime in, David?
So you said you're developing primarily around SQL Server 2012? Is that 2012, 2014? So are you doing anything around like visualization, reporting in your application?
Yeah, we do. A lot.
Okay. SQL Server 2016 from a reporting perspective. I mean, we haven't seen... I guess when you say what's new with reporting services, the exciting thing is that there's something new with reporting services.
Oh,
the last major change that we've had is SQL Server 2008 R2. And what they've done in this release is unbelievable with the DataZen capabilities, at-a-glance reporting, the entire UI being rebuilt, the hybrid connective model. So for an ISV, I would be very excited about not just what's available in SQL Server 2016, but where that entire hybrid reporting story is going. And it's really cool stuff.
Well, since you brought up the BI component, and it wasn't really touched much in this conference, but do you know if Microsoft done anything with the BI components in terms of Azure and making HA?
Are you referring to, like, give me more? What are
like,
you
for
mean?
Instance, we struggle right now because our application uses analysis service on-premise right now. And so when we move it up to Azure on an Azure VM, and it has that whole maintenance window, and it doesn't really support availability set really cleanly. I was wondering if there was any work done in that area.
I don't know a whole lot about what they're doing with analysis services. And
how about reporting service?
Reporting services, there's a tremendous amount that they're doing. So you have the ability, and I did cover this. So look for, reporting services 2016 features and capabilities. I have a whole section where I'm covering Power BI as well. In reporting services 2016, you can take report items and pin them to a Power BI dashboard. You could go from Excel and take a chart or a graph from Excel and pin it to the same dashboard. I could then open up PowerPoint and pull down those assets to PowerPoint and refresh those on demand. That's cool.
And the only thing I would say in there too is that no, when you do that stuff, you're taking a dependency on 2016. With stuff like the cardinality estimator and query store, you don't even have to take a dependency on 2016. It's the carrot that you can dangle in front of customers. If you go to 2016, you're going to get better performance, better troubleshooting and all that. Then later, as adoption spreads, then you can take a dependency on it.
But you did say you were developing for 2012 and 2014. If you haven't moved to 2012 or 2014 yet, I'm a bigger fan of moving to 2016. But as an ISV, the problem that you're going to have is you won't be able to back up restore from 2008 to 2016 directly. So it's kind of a bummer. I mean, you're going to almost have to go to 2012 or 2014 or work with your customers to move their database once to one of those so that they can then move to your product on 2016. So, I mean, you're in a little bit more of a dilemma being an ISV. So,
the good thing is that you're already playing with 2014. So you're not going to have a major upgrade gap that of all,
especially cost wise and so forth. So at least, I guess if you go to 2014, then you could maybe do your development there and then go to 2018, maybe skip, because obviously you're not like bleeding edge tomorrow because it takes a while to get all this out to the customers. That's always true for ISVs. So it might actually be that you go to 14 now, get everybody there because you can make that hop, and then always go 2 because you can't go more than 2 anyway with backup restore. So that might be the best choice.
All right, I have another question here. Your name?
Hi, I'm David from Minneapolis. SQL Server on Linux, what do you think the future holds? Do you think it'll be a success, a bust? Big question mark?
I think it's interesting.
I think it's very interesting as well. I think I'm not sure exactly why they're doing it, but one of the reasons you can think of is to have Oracle shops that run a lot on Linux to be able to kick the tires of SQL Server, for instance, so to try and get people to come over from that.
I think it's going to be about as effective as Oracle is on Windows. I think it's kind of an also-ran. It's a demonstration that, sure, we do multiple platforms, but this isn't really something that people go, I gotta have Oracle because it's on Windows. No, it just doesn't really come up. I don't think that there's going to be that raving fan of, I gotta have SQL Server now that it's on Linux. I know that I'm in the minority, though, of like MVP presenters and that kind of thing, the old man in the cloud kind of approach.
So yeah, I'm not expecting it's going to be a huge, huge thing. Like, I'm not saying I'm going to go and hire somebody from my consulting business that's going to do just SQL on Linux for my clients.
I was hoping I could use the word, it depends. So for us...
No, I'm sorry, you can't.
That's for the answers,
so
not for the questions.
For us, we're a Java shop. We were originally Oracle way back then, and then we had the whole Oracle compete, and then we're almost off SQL Server right now, but we still have a huge, huge, like half of the developers are Java hardcore Linux developers, and they are super excited about, you know, SQL Server on Linux.
Because they can take MySQL out of the LAMP stack and stick SQL Server in and try that.
Right? I mean, they don't want to develop on Windows anymore. They don't want to be on a Windows desktop. I mean, they want to be on SQL, on Linux. And this gives them the ability just to be on pure.
That's cool.
So why aren't they going to Postgres?
Oh, I told them that if they supported another database, I'd actually quit the company.
You have got to be good.
Nicely done.
You are good.
I got to think it's the management side. I mean, the folks who run Linux servers have a really interesting set of management tools, Nagios and the like. And it's really tough to add new OSs that you need to take care of and have care and feeding on, reporting on. So that's a very compelling part of that. I'm also absolutely convinced that if and when this product exists and starts to work, there will be another TPCC race, right? Or a tech and power race. It'll be about the benchmarks for a while just to see who can really wring the most out of a machine. And that's good for everybody. Windows, Linux, doesn't matter, you know, SQL Server or Oracle. I love those races.
Better apples to apples comparisons. So that'll be good.
And see who really took it on the right way. Cause there's always been lots of arguments about the query processing approaches and so forth. Well, you know, let's put them on the same racetrack and see what happens.
What'll be interesting there is to see whether the SQL OS layer becomes one SQL OS that actually works for both. And so there might be performance issues because it's now got several different code paths, whether there'll be a SQL OS just for Linux and a SQL OS just for Windows, handling all the thread scheduling, memory management, and so on.
Yeah, because at the OS level, they're very different.
Absolutely.
And continue to change. You know, I was thinking about, you know, Peter's comment on 2008 R2 and think, just think of how the thread scheduling model has changed in the OS since that time span. Like, that's a big deal. For a web guy like me, like, when we went from IIS 8 to 8.5 and the underlying OS changed the thread scheduling model, like, apps went faster. Like, no, I didn't do anything except an upgrade. It was stunning, the difference that makes. Another question here.
We have SQL 2008 R2. We're using the SSRS. So this kind of goes back to the whole new 2016 SSRS. Is it going to be the standard practice as it was with 2008 R2 and 2012 that all the goodies are in enterprise and not in standard?
Go ahead. Go ahead, David. Go ahead.
David. Go on record,
that
David.
It's all yours.
So give me an example of a goodie.
Subscriptions, report subscriptions.
Well, there are data-driven
subscriptions are still enterprise.
Our developers were building some on their developer machines, and they couldn't. I can't remember what they couldn't. They couldn't do having to do with jumping to different database, like jumping to other servers and stuff at the same time in the same report.
Okay, so keep in mind that it has not released yet. So I can't speak to that directly yet, but some of the capabilities that we had, for example, Brent brought up subscriptions, data-driven subscriptions. I would expect that to still be an enterprise feature. That's one of the big ones.
Yeah, that's one of the ones we wanted.
Expect that to still be enterprise. Email me. David.plus@Microsoft. I will be happy to talk about that.
So we can still persuade that outcome, can we, David?
Connect on Microsoft.com, and I would give your feedback.
We want all the things in the free edition.
Express.
But yeah.
Walt Gamera with BuildASign. I've heard it said, and I'm not a DBA, so forgive me. I've heard it said that when you're configuring your SQL Server, you should keep your data store on a separate drive from your tempdb drive. What about if you're using a SAN for your storage? Is it okay to keep your tempdb and your data in the same drive?
For me, it's usually more about a management perspective and less about performance. Even if they're all in the same spindles, I will often want tempdb on a dedicated volume or LUN, and I'm going to pre-grow out those files to the size of that LUN, just so that I know now I'm done. And there's differences on, some people will say 4 data files, some people will say 8. Whatever route you go with that, grow them out and you're done. Whereas if they're on the same volume with the user databases, you can have somebody run an out of control query and take up all the space on the user database drives, which just makes management a little tougher. I'm kind of okay with them filling up their own dedicated drive. Worst case scenario, I restart SQL Server and I'm off to the races, or add another file, whatever it is I want to do that. I just don't want everybody camped out on that same volume in that. It also has a difference with snapshots. If I want to take snapshot backups, I want to just snap the user database files. I don't want to snap tempdb. So the less I have to copy for system databases, the better.
Is there any incentive to have tempdb on a SAN? I mean, that seems like you want it as local as you can get.
SAN vendors have debts too. They want nicer cars, houses.
SAN people want you to use more SAN.
Of course, a big draw with the local solid state drives in 2012 and newer, you can use them in a cluster for tempdb. So it's so much cheaper. It's like $200 a terabyte now for raw space. So I would always rather use local space and tempdb for clusters. But if you don't have that luxury, then yeah, you get stuck on the SAN. Like virtualization is the classic example.
Mm-hmm. And it depends how much use you make of tempdb. Just because you have a tempdb, your workload might not use it.
Yeah, it's aggregate queries and all those other fun things that wanted to have a big scratch pad to work from.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the bits of advice, I just covered it in my myths and misconceptions sessions, is if you have SSDs, you always put tempdb in your transaction logs on it. Well, what if they're not the hotspots in your workload?
Right. Yeah, all of these never and always make me nervous.
Yes.
Right? That's just not a thing that's correct. If it was that easy, you guys wouldn't have jobs.
Quiet crowd.
Yeah, well, you know, I think maybe you guys did such a good job this week.
Everything they need to know.
Yeah, no. You guys killed it this week. Anything fun on the hardware perspective right now? Oh, I'll pass it over here.
So we have a quite big infrastructure, and just wanted to get an exposure on how would you do licensing, inventory management, and you know, some of the tools that you have experience with, if you can share.
I go to, in Newark, New Jersey, there's this guy in an alley who sells me all kinds of licenses. He swears they're new, just got them off the truck, fell off the truck.
You know what's funny, building on that little story? One of my developers, back when I was on the Microsoft team, Chinese guy, went back to China to visit his family. This was in 2003. And he saw that the street vendors were selling Microsoft SQL Server 2003. And he asked them why, and he said, because it's been too long since the older version came out, so we just created a new one to get people to buy it.
Just changed the name.
And it was SQL Server 2000 in a 2003 box.
Nice. Nice. Very nice. How's it sound? It's pretty well like hotcakes.
Yeah, so for me, it depends on how you buy licensing. So some shops will have an enterprise agreement. If you have an enterprise agreement, you usually have a dedicated person who manages licensing and management of multiple boxes. The next drop down is if you do something like a select where you're getting licensing on a regular basis. In that case, I usually like having somebody from accounting keep track of those because they're also the ones who know where all the licensing is. They can go back and through recent P&Ls and balance sheets to see when the expenditures happen. And they're more responsible than us geeks. We like leave pizza boxes on top of the licensing. Nobody really pays attention. But it's more for me of an accounting function than it is for IT tracking licensing expenditures. That's also because I don't like licensing, and I'd rather, you know, dodge that work. I'm like, hey, Johnny from accounting, why don't you take this over?
Sir.
Hey, I'm Jim from Destin, Florida. I was just curious, with your existing customers and the market in general, are you seeing more people, the ones that are going to the cloud, are they putting SQL databases on virtual machines, or are they using SQL Azure, or are there certain scenarios for where one is better than the other, and how do you see that going in the future?
Go first.
Man, I get all the fun stuff. Jeremiah and I are doing a postcon on that tomorrow, actually. And so we're going to talk about how when you choose infrastructure as a service versus when you choose platform as a service. If I was starting a new app today from scratch, ground up, I would totally go platform as a service via Azure SQL DB or Amazon RDS. One of those deals where I don't have to hire a DBA. They handle the stupid plumbing like backup and check DB. That's really intelligent plumbing, actually, not stupid at all. But the parts of database administration that I don't enjoy a lot, that's perfect. Right now, I don't see a lot of customers taking their databases as is and dropping them on platform as a service because it's like Hotel California. It's hard to check in and check out. So, whereas infrastructure as a service, it's really easy to check in and out. And a lot of database administrators are more comfortable with that. So you have pre-existing databases, easier to infrastructure as a service, new databases from scratch, platform as a service. I'm generalizing, but
on top of that, I mean, are you virtualizing already?
That's not a rhetorical question. Oh, he doesn't have a microphone.
He's a DoD contractor, so no.
Okay. Oh, that's a quick answer.
So,
whatever the government's doing is what's going on here. Okay. Is much of that virtual?
So I would say, I'll say it from this perspective. It depends. I would agree with Brent. If for new development, platform as a service is awesome. You're going to take advantage of the Azure Fabric and its building blocks, like Power BI for visualizations and all the other components and capabilities in Azure. But if you have a solution on-prem, this is something established, something all within the confines of a virtual machine or any existing environment, IaaS makes the most sense.
Is that even an option for your customer to go onto the cloud? As a DoD, yeah, I just can't imagine DoD going for anything other than on-prem. I've worked for those guys. Yeah, they don't make a decision globally. They make it literally team by team. Yeah, I've been through that one. It's very challenging, but it's interesting that you're even asking the question, just that, is it a possibility for your customer?
It'll happen. It's, you know, they're trying to write their own at the same time. Another group, Microsoft's put a lot of effort into having Azure be available for government. And then, you know, at the same time, one portion has already gotten approved on Amazon.
Wow.
I mean, it's partly a selfish question, too, just for my own career in the future of where people are going and what are they doing. And I think we all need to obviously address
it. I would say over the last year, it's certainly picked up a lot. Mm-hmm. It's been real slow to get going.
And it's finally ready for prime time. Yeah. I mean, we finally have cloud features before box features. We actually have a fully available product to us. Whereas there were a lot of features that weren't accessible to us in earlier releases. So we have a lot more accessible. Did you want to add something?
Like, I mean, until a year ago, I and my company, we weren't looking at doing Azure consulting.
Your company?
It is my company. Ooh. Ooh.
I know where somebody isn't sleeping tonight.
We both say that all the time. I, when we mean we. Yeah, we didn't do any Azure consulting.
So it's the royal I? Is that what you said?
Because there was no demand for it.
Yeah.
Now we're seeing demand. So now we're starting doing it.
That's a real interesting insight there, Paul. It's just it feels like it's turned a corner.
Absolutely.
All right, second question.
We're currently using the
EMC Celera backup file share to do a backup solution, and it's fairly busy. We write the transaction log backup and also the SQL audits to it. The EMC now, they're migrated from Celera to Isilon, and I can notice the change because we used to each different backup file share, we have a different IPs. So I know it seems isolated. But for the new solution, they gave me one IP for more than 10 shares on it. To me, it's a change of design, but they said the old one is wrong, the new one is correct. So, I'm wondering, is there a way I can easily to tell if the solution can give me the same throughput as the current? Because the current is already heavily used, and I can't stop the load on it. And this one is idle. So if I put performance counters or whatever I do, SQL IO or SQL SPD, what's the best way to tell if it gave me the same throughput?
That's actually really easy. MSDB, we track all the backup. Like I have anything to do with this. Microsoft tracks all the backup history, so it tells you when the backup started and when the backup finished. So you can calculate throughput over that time. Start backing up to the new devices and see whether they get you the same throughput. I didn't say runtime, because runtime will change based on the size of the databases, but start gradually adding more and more backups into there. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, if I switch the backup to it, yeah. I think you're right. I can tell. But my issue is I don't want to switch to it yet.
Until
because
you know
once it's... I switch, if not working, I have to put it back.
Yeah.
So I want to just avoid this back and forth.
Sure.
So is there any way to tell before I switch?
So there's two parts to your question. One is changing back and forth. You can use something called a DNS CNAME. So you set every server up with a DNS CNAME where their backups are going to go. Then you can change that IP address. You and your network team can change that IP address easily without touching every backup device. But if the second part of that is, how do I test the storage throughput? Crystal Disk Mark. Crystal Disk Mark is the easy button for storage testing. You can't run it just on one machine. You have to run it from several simultaneously if you really want to push this device to its limits. They do not have to be SQL servers. They can be any Windows machines. So they can be desktops, Windows VMs in the same data center. Run simultaneous CDM tests.
Okay, so is that valid test when one is already have lots of load on it? And if I run on both, that's still comparable.
Yeah, yeah. So you can do it with 20 Windows desktops. Fire away Crystal Disk Mark at 20 Windows desktops at the exact same time pointing to this file share and see what happens next.
And Crystal Disk Mark is completely free.
Totally, yes.
And it's very widely used. It's safe to use. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Folks, I got to interrupt for one moment because I need to pay the bills. This episode of Run As Radio is brought to you by Royal TS, the comprehensive remote management solution for Windows, OS X, iOS, and Android. Whether you're using RDP, VNC, SSH, or even web-based interfaces for remote management, Royal TS has you covered. Royal TS for Windows can be used for common remote management tasks like executing PowerShell scripts, managing Windows services, and much more. With Royal Server, you can even do this on OS X, iOS, and soon Android. Free to download for up to 10 connections or use the coupon code RUNASRADIO for 30% off an individual user license at royalapplications.com/RUNASRADIO. All right, we had another question over here. Sir.
My name's David, and I'm from Rockford, Illinois. I just had a question about SQL Azure. Is there any tools? I've got an existing on-premises application. I want to move it to SQL Azure. Is there any tools to predict the cost once I've moved it?
There's the DTU calculator.
That's an interesting one.
That's an interesting
you
one.
Know more about that than me.
Tim just did it. Tim, you want to run up and talk to that?
So DTU, while he comes up, is database throughput units, and it's a thing that you use to measure cost in Azure. What's tougher is that there's no built-in DMVs for today for on-premises databases to know your DTU consumption. That's where Tim comes in. Tim, tell him all about it.
All right, so the DTU calculator is basically just a PowerShell script. So you can download the DTU calculator. If you see me after, I can give you the actual website, but just Bing DTU calculator. It's a PowerShell script. You run it. You can configure it to point to your data drive and your transaction log location. It will collect some various metrics and log flushes and things like that. And then you upload the CSV file, which is just a list of those metrics. You specify the number of cores that that machine was running under. And then it will come back and give you an estimate of what size pricing tier that you need, whether a basic, standard, premium, and which level. And then you can determine the actual cost. And it's really cool. It shows you a graph. So even though it may tell you that you need a standard 2, which is up to X number of DTU, you may see that you spike above that. But if it's just a little, you know, a quick spike, then maybe you don't need a 250 DTU machine because you only need that for a second at a time. So it's a really good starting point. Is that going to be definitive what you actually need? Maybe, maybe not. So you definitely want to capture multiple baselines. You know, maybe morning time, afternoon, you know, evening time, to get that good rounded out, you know, value, and then kind of take that mean. And that's a good place to start.
So it gets you in the ballpark anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. It can be good enough to get an idea of whether you're looking at something that's going to cost you $100 a month or like $10,000 a month.
Wait, one more comment.
So when I've helped customers with this, a couple of things. One, probably the most critical thing you need to do is find the best workload, a defined workload that represents your application.
A heavy workload or just a common workload?
I would find your key workloads and be aware of all windows. And you may find, kind of like to the point, is that you may want to schedule a ramp up to a larger machine, a larger database. DTUs is a mix of memory, CPU, and IO. You may want to look at elasticity if it's not predictable. So you have a scenario where you will ramp up and ramp down based on need, and you can define, much like Resource Governor, you can define how you will fluctuate and what databases will be using what consumption in a particular range. For min and max.
And don't just think about your query workload. Think about things that might happen overnight, like major ETLs that might happen once every couple of weeks, index maintenance, check DBs, stuff like that.
And both of us forgot to mention feature. If you need active geo-replication, you need a premium tier. If you can deal with standard geo-replication, then you can be in a standard tier. If you need 35 days backup history, then you need premium. If you need a 500 gig database, you're in premium or higher, up to the P11, up to a terabyte. So both based on workload and feature set that you may need will determine where you fall into. In memory OLTP, you know, those types of things. So
it's just sort of baseline things. Like if you need any of these things, don't look below premium. It's not happening.
Exactly.
And then go to your workloads. All right. Peter's got a question.
Yeah. It's Peter again from Houston.
He's already asked a question.
Yay, Peter!
So I'm looking at the potential topics here, and I understand most of them, but can you elaborate the data type choice? What do you mean by that?
One for Kimberly.
All right. Hold on, let me start the stopwatch.
Start the timer.
Yeah.
For those listening in the audience and at home, Kimberly currently holds the record for the longest answer at 7 minutes, 45 seconds.
I think part of that started from questions that we were getting about new data types that came into SQL 2008. We had new date time data types. We had like date time 2, for example. So we were getting questions for that for a while. There's also something that's kind of near and dear to me, which is
why we started the timer.
I know. This is so recently I saw somebody say, does anybody care about, you know, data type choice or database design anymore? You know, I've got cheap storage and cheap hardware. Disk space is cheap. It doesn't matter. So who cares anymore? And I get a little bit frustrated by that, maybe more than a little bit, because bad design is never going to be able to scale really well no matter what. I mean, you can throw more hardware at it, yes. And sometimes throwing more hardware at a problem when you can't control the software, to your point, might be an idea to solve some of the problems that you're running into. And I, you know, we all pick on SharePoint, but I'm just saying, you know, sometimes when you can't change the architecture, or even as an ISV, sometimes you want your customers to upgrade to get better throughput because you know that the next version is going to handle it, but you're a little bit far off on the next version, that kind of thing. So sometimes hardware can help, but if we choose the right data types early, like I remember one customer where every single time they used a date, they used date time. And they never used time, and all of their dates were for products that were created in the last, like, 30 years. And they could have very easily used small date time. And maybe not the best example, but let's say, because this was back when we only had date time and small date time. But the point is they had all these columns and there were dozens of them across multiple tables that were 8 bytes instead of 4. So we were, you know, 8 bytes, 8 bytes, 8 bytes. And a lot of people start saying to me, oh, who cares about 8 bytes versus 4 bytes? You're right. On a single row, you don't care about 8 bytes versus 4 bytes for 10 columns. But I guess that most of you guys have more than one row, right? And when you start talking about hundreds of thousands of rows, or let's say millions or hundreds of millions, which now these days is becoming commonplace, most of you probably have tables in the tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of rows. And if every one of those rows is 100 bytes larger than it needs to be, that's actually way more interesting than you might think. I mean, you'd be talking about like 150 gig of wasted space on one table just because you have a few columns that are wider than they need to be. So that's now one table. So let's say we're wasting, you know, hundreds of gigabytes here, hundreds of gigabytes here, hundreds of gigabytes here, hundreds of gigabytes here. Now our whole database is bloated, our backups are bloated, we're logging more than we need to, we're caching more than we'd need to, and we're having to go to new hardware sooner because our hardware can't keep up because we can't scale. So, that was my quick data types
What about that example?
You guys are just trying to get the timer to be longer.
Oh, God, I thought it would work.
My point is database design always matters, and a lot of people are just trying to get that database out there quickly. And then they'll deal with the problems later, right? Let's just get it out there and we'll fix the performance later. I hear that all the time. And there are some things, my favorite line, the sooner you begin to code, the longer it's going to take. So if you create a crappy schema and then you write a whole bunch of code on it and you get that into production, it is going to be incredibly hard to fix that schema because then you have to fix all of that code and nobody wants to do that. So then you live with it much longer than you should. So good design is much more scalable, putting more time earlier on. You know, what's the measure twice, cut once? It's the same concept here. If you spend some time on prototyping, you will find so many problems earlier that won't cause you grief later. I know, they're still timing me. So anyway.
Well, hold on, Jeremy.
I just love that you're making renovation commentary, Kim, because that's one of those things you just nail.
So she cares about it so much, there's actually, she has a 4-hour course on data type choice, essentially, on Pluralsight.
It's called Why Physical Database Design Matters. And I've had great feedback because people don't think about that stuff. And once I throw it in their face and say, look, if you don't think about it, it does this, they kind of go, oh, I guess I should be thinking about that. And that was the point of it. So, Jeremiah.
So I start, before Kimberly starts, I actually start with logical design. And when you choose the right data types, this goes along with actually having a domain and a model for your data. So when I look at an age column, and age is tiny int, I know it's probably going to be years. And if it's like a decimal, it's probably going to be seconds or milliseconds. And so having the right data types helps somebody else coming in understand my application and my database much more quickly. I'm going to know roughly what's going to be in those columns instead of guessing and having to go find somebody. And they're going to pull out the data modeling tool that nobody's updated in 15 years and go, I don't know, it's a cat.
No, absolutely. I mean, consistency among the data types, a data catalog, yeah.
I'm not even going to talk about my VCAR 1000 tables then. Another question here? Oh, by a couple of rows.
That guy's going, what? I'm not going to ask that question. Go away.
Kelly from San Diego. Could you guys describe any experience you have implementing a hybrid solution where maybe you had SQL and a NoSQL implementation? So we do a lot of where we've scaled our SQL by having a read-write server and then replicating to a bunch of read-only servers and spreading the load that way. But as we cook the data with ETL or replication, we've also thought maybe we should cook to a document DB.
So a lot of it is you just put the right stuff in the right database. Very often SQL Server is an awesome Swiss Army knife. I mean, you can put all kinds of different things or work on different things with it. But as you need to scale, and the example I usually give is at a terabyte, as I start to approach a terabyte, I go, all right, let's revisit how fast it is to back up and restore this database, how easy it is to make it perform. And that's when I start pulling things out, take files out of the database, take the queuing out of the database, take text search out of the database, and put those in platforms that make more sense.
I could throw some stuff in here because sometimes I wear the .NET Rocks hat too. And certainly we've had a lot of conversations about when we mix NoSQL and databases. And one of the points that's been made, and this is a very dev way of thinking about things, is why are we making the customer wait while we decompose a set of objects that represent an order into rows and columns? Why don't we just store the object? Let the guy go about his business, free up our resources, and then asynchronously decompose those objects into a relational data store, because that relational data store is still the best way for us to analyze our data, to run reporting against our data. But putting it on the front end is unnecessary. And the side effect of that has been a substantial speed up on the front end. So you're taking orders faster, which is always good. The other part of that is you have to do your due diligence about your data store. We kind of forget. We've had SQL Server for so long now. It works. Its backup is reliable. Its transactions are reliable. All that stuff just works. And as soon as you start playing with another data store as a responsible DBA or just somebody responsible about data, you got to check all that again. Does this thing really write to disk when it says it writes to disk? Is it recoverable? You know, how does it restore? How do we back it up? What happens when you do those things? Because they're different, right? And I'm not saying they're good or bad. You know, one of the sponsors here at the conference was RavenDB. That's Oren Rahin, and he makes a document store that's transactional, right? Follows ACID. It's interesting to look at, but it's taking on a piece on the back end as well as, you know, fulfilling some developers' ease of use goals. So, you know, you have a role to play in that. But, you know, we definitely saw with certain customers that we've had on the show, it's a performance benefit and it's sort of making right peg and right hole.
And I'd also say anytime SQL Server brings out a feature or a different way of storing data, you need to ask those same tough questions about SQL Server as well. In-memory OLTP, CheckDB is still not supported. Even in SQL Server 2016, CheckDB simply skips in-memory.
That's not
objects.
My fault, by the way, people. I left before 2008.
They need you back. Yeah, so you have those same kinds of discussions you have to answer. Stretch tables. Once the data goes up to the cloud, how are you doing CheckDB? Because right now, it's totally open and out there. So up here, and behind you too, either way. Oh, well, they're everywhere except where you're looking.
Yep.
A quick question. Can you describe the difference between cardinality estimation in 2012 and 2016?
Hey, Brett, before we get started, how long did that go?
It was only 4 minutes and a half.
Oh, lightweight one. Okay.
Yeah.
But we've started the clock again.
Yeah.
Seriously. it's not a simple answer, but...
Perfect.
That's why we started the clock.
For many years, SQL Server had the same estimation model across versions, and it was based on older hardware. Having said that, all of the estimations that they were making were at least the same across all the different algorithms that they might choose within one, let's say, execution, right? So maybe you're joining and you're joining a couple of tables. They're at least going to say, okay, the IO is going to cost us this much here. The IO is going to cost us this much here. What's our estimate of the number of rows? Multiply all that out. How much is this join going to cost us? And what they found is over the years, some of those estimations and the way they came up with how many rows they thought would be in that set were not necessarily what they actually saw in the real world. Let me give you a better example, okay? If I ask you how many products are red, right? And you tell me a third of your products are red. And then I ask you how many of your products are square, okay? And you tell me a quarter of your products are square. How many of them are red squares? How many of them are both red and square? How many? Some of you would say, well, if a quarter of the red products are square, because a third of my products are red and a quarter of my products are square, and you say a third of my products are red and a quarter of those are square, then you'd say 1/12 of your products are red and square. That is making an assumption. That is making an assumption that you are essentially evenly distributed across those different estimations. And that is what the old model would do. Okay, the old model would assume that. Now, what if in your products, you don't make squares that are red? Well, then that's totally wrong. But how is SQL Server going to know that? How is SQL Server going to know, oh, your products that are square are never red? If they only have statistical information on shape and statistical information on color, then when they estimate the number of rows, they have to do some type of analysis to figure that out. And they've changed some of the ways they do that. What they now do is something called exponential backoff. And I don't have to geek out on the numbers and so forth, but it's not 1/12 anymore. But here's the problem. 1/12 might be right for some of you. The new model, which would be 1/4 times 1/9, 1/36. So for some of you, 1/36 might be better. They're not assuming that everything's correlated and evenly distributed anymore, so you're going to get estimations that are a little bit lower in some cases, right? 1/36 rather than 1/12. Is that right? In some cases, yes, and in some cases, no. In some cases, the other one was right. The point is that the new cardinality estimation model, what they found is when they went through a large number of sample queries that were, you know, running against SQL, they found that they got better and closer estimations with the new model than with the old. So that was the large reason for the changes. The problem, however, is that doesn't work for everybody everywhere all the time. So
that's just a tyranny of the majority problem, right? You're always going to have that. Just because it works for bulk cases,
an optimizer has to find a good plan fast. It can't find the best plan all the time. That's not its job. And it's got to try to get that information from things like statistics. Now, if you had statistics on shape and color, if you had indexes that maybe had multiple columns in them, then there are things that we will know better about the combinations, but not necessarily specific combinations. So the point is, I personally generally tell people to upgrade to 2014, leaving the compatibility model at the old version that they're coming from. And as they have problems, test the new CE and test, obviously, everything under the new CE. But if they have a lot of regressions, to go back to the old CE, stick with it, and then slowly upgrade things that they need the new CE for. So it's a tough one, though, because I've seen some environments where they did get better performance, but I've seen some environments where they changed to the new CE model and they have problems, and they have problems that are pretty significant. So it's not a magic bullet. It's not something that's going to fix all your problems. In fact, it's going to fix some, but it's going to introduce others.
Every solution comes with a new set of problems.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that helps. Who asked that question again? I mean, is there more that you want to ask on that? It's tough. It's a really, that's like my whole workshop tomorrow is about how SQL Server comes up with the estimates. How does SQL Server look at the indexes? You know, are your statistics good? Could they be better? Are there things you could do to get better statistics as your tables get larger? The histogram internally becomes a little lossy. So even forget the cardinality estimation model for a second. Even how they base their estimates might be inaccurate because their statistics aren't as effective. I know. Keep looking at that timer. And the point is there are things you can do to me that feed into the optimizer to give it the best information it can have so it does a good job optimizing. Because regardless of what the optimizer is going to decide or do or how it figures out what it's going to do, if you give it bad information, it only gets worse. So there's a lot of things you can do without worrying about exactly, you know, oh, is it 1/12? Is it 1/36? You don't care that level in a lot of cases. You just want to make sure that the information you give it is as accurate, as detailed as, and there are limitations in SQL where sometimes that doesn't happen, like statistics. So, you need to make sure they're up to date. I mean, gosh, you guys know that, right? You know that when stats are out of date, you can have problems. Oh, stop it. So
to your original question, which is what's different, Microsoft Research actually published an excellent and accessible white paper about what exactly is different,
well, both
from
a
theoretical
and
implementation standpoint. So this is also a fifth the length of Joe Sack's white paper.
Oh, come on. But Joe gives all sorts of examples and stuff, too. So.
They're both good.
Is there another question over here?
Ladies, you're all pretty.
Up the front.
We got Kimberly for 6 minutes, 20 seconds.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
10% of our hour.
Yeah.
So.
All right, I'm done then. I'll sit down for the rest.
I have a 2005 database. I was wondering if you could tell me how long it would take DBCC to run.
It depends.
Well done.
Start that timer.
Nice one. Yeah.
Zero. It's out of support.
Oh, yeah.
Darkness. 2005. Wow, 11 years old. Question here in the middle.
Hi, my name is Aarti Shetty. I'm from Greenwich, Connecticut. So recently I read an article from Microsoft where they say treat all your community updates similar to your service packs going forward. So what does that mean for us when 2016 is here, and should we just keep going with the community updates, or should we wait till it
Mr. Aaron happens? Bertrand.
We have Aaron Bertrand here in the audience.
So
Mr. Service Pack.
For a long time, there were disclaimers all over the cumulative update pages that said, don't apply this unless you're suffering from this exact problem. That's no longer true. And the reason that they did that was because they didn't perform as rigorous regression testing on those cumulative updates, because they assumed that only a small percentage of customers would apply them. And what they realized is that they actually want to deliver more of those fixes faster in those updates. And they are testing them much more thoroughly now. And that's why the messaging has changed, and why you no longer have to enter your email and download the file and then apply a password to open it and all of that nonsense. You can just download the latest CU for any of the current branches directly from Microsoft Downloads.
With 2016, we just keep going as
far. When 2016 CU1 comes out, I'm going to apply it immediately.
The other way you could look at this is they're now putting the same level of testing into both cumulative updates and service packs, which means they're just not testing service packs all that much either anymore.
That's not cynical at all, Brent.
Okay, now, a counterpoint to that is this is all fantastic. That doesn't mean that every time a new CU comes out, you all go and install it, because that means you all have to go and do testing of your entire application to make sure that they didn't change something that breaks you. Okay.
Well, especially that they're shipping
more stuff.
You've
got to be careful. You're not just going to go and install everything.
DMV changes in CUs now. Right. I mean, it's been.
And what's in that CU? Put this in right away. There's a key item that you need to fix with the reporting services. What if you're not using reporting services? So if you do it absolutely every time, look at the details. Does it apply to you? Are you using those technologies? What is the impact to your business of these technologies? Maybe it's solving a problem that you don't realize is affecting your business. Then definitely you want to test it. But I would not say that every single time a new CU comes out, you should right away immediately install it.
In our environment, we have a mixed database, mixed vendor kind of in some cases. So what applies to one does not apply to another.
Agreed.
So we are forced to put the cumulative updates, hoping that, nothing else breaks it, you know, so.
That is a very good point. In fact, so in some ways it makes it more difficult, but for the purposes of uptime and testing and everything else, you really need to look at each case scenario and what is in the guts of that CU and how does it affect that instance and how are you using that instance for your business.
Is that as much assessing risk to the applying that than anything else? It's like, is this going to hit at the heart of what my app really counts on?
Right.
If you're changing the query processor, everybody cares. You wouldn't do that, would you? One more question.
Actually, going along with the CU, so if CU3 comes out and you've tested it, it's got something that's broke that breaks your stuff because you have a developer that doesn't know how to code. If you do that, if you go to CU4, isn't that going to include CU3, or are they doing so if you skip one, you're not going to know what you're putting in for 4,
right,
that might affect.
But if there's a bug in CU3, one would hope they would have fixed it in
CU4. No. He's saying a bug in his client code, his application code.
Yeah,
that he never tested for CU3, and then he goes to CU4.
Yes, you'll have the same.
Because he looks at CU4.
Because they're now going to be completely cumulative, where everything prior is in the latest one.
Once you take the step off the CU train, you're off. You can't get back on again.
Or fix your code.
You'd fix your code.
You got to fix the code.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's also too, if you're going to go to CU4 and you're currently at CU1, you can't just look at CU4's details.
No.
You have to look at what was fixed in CU2, what was fixed in CU2 or 3, and what's fixed in CU4, and then you'll be able to upgrade. But
this this is the realities of databases today. Like if I look at Azure SQL DB, you're on that hamster wheel. It's coming. The updates are coming. You know, if Microsoft discontinues support for something, takes out a feature, you got to react. And to some extent, that's what the database world is today.
And that's why I advocate applying the CUs as they come out, not, the CU's out. Okay, so I'm going to put it on all my production instances this moment, but testing them right away, because if you skip a CU, then you just have double testing to do when the next CU comes out and affects you.
Yeah, I agree.
So why defer that work when you can do it in much smaller incremental pieces?
Now, hold on. What do you mean by double testing? Surely you have a set of application correctness tests. You run them. They pass. You're okay. So why do you have to do double for the next CU? Surely it's the same set of tests. They pass or not.
Well, your application is changing also.
You didn't say that. You just said you're applying a CU. Why is your app changing?
Okay, but you also have to see what are the fixes that I'm testing against. So is there?
But you're still not doing double testing. You have an application correctness test, or you should have, that says my app is performing perfectly in performance and correctness. That's it.
The problem is not too many people.
Not too many people have that.
But you're doing one set of testing. You should have a set of tests that proves your app is okay.
To that argument would mean it's in my best interest to wait two or three CUs.
And that's why I'm saying you shouldn't necessarily feel obliged to go in and put every single one on, unless there's a bug that affects you.
Right. But the test suite is the test suite. Presumably you have complete test coverage. So once you run the tests and they pass, you're good. So you could skip a few, then run the test once and everything's fine because everybody's got awesome test suites.
But it could degenerate into a philosophical argument, which I will never agree on.
Yes. Almost every CU has had either a data corruption or wrong results or...
You are playing into my point that you should not install every single one then.
I'm not saying install them in production. I'm saying test them.
Yeah. By the way, this is what going to a bar is like with these guys.
Not I'm saying they have a fix for a corruption issue that might be affecting you or might affect you tomorrow that you don't know yet.
That's the most recent special case, though.
The most recent CU,
we had four corruption and incorrect results bugs. I was laughing. I'm like, come on.
It's not like your server pops out of sight and says, I've got corrupt data on it.
Right. Unless you run CheckDB. Fabulous, fabulous tool.
Handcrafted. Folks, we are out of time. It is 4:15. It's time to break for the closing session. Thank you so much for coming out to this hour-long Q&A on Run As Radio. And talk to you next week.